typically pick a short label. So for example, I have here one sentence that says understand. I tap on it, and what will happen is that it will then generate full screen the text, I can understand you, but I'm not able to speak.
This week on Download This Show, smartwatches for disabilities. How developers are rethinking what you can do with Apple Watches and Android Wear. Plus, hackers on a plane. How one man may have temporarily taken control of a plane via the in-flight entertainment system and what it could mean for the future of flying. And how the internet for all could actually be a bad thing. This is your guide to the week in technology, the internet and culture. My name is Mark Fennell, and right across Australia, welcome to Download This Show. Yes, indeed, the show is still called Download This Show, even though increasingly people seem to stream it, and I believe some people listen to it on the radio. Don't forget, you can tweet along. The hashtag is, surprisingly enough, Download This Show, and it is a very big welcome to our panel. He is the editor of Gizmodo Australia, Luke Hopewell. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
And you can read her work on Kotaku, Lifehacker. You can see her on Mornings on the Nine Network. Ray Johnson, welcome back.
Hello, thank you.
Now, first up today, something terrible. If you're somebody who is afraid of flying, this is going to fill you with dread. A US hacker named Chris Roberts was detained by the FBI this week, and he had his computer seized for about 5 hours after he published tweets suggesting that he could use in-flight Wi-Fi to hack into a plane's controls or quote-unquote other systems, including the emergency oxygen. And at one point, he even tweeted about the ability to execute the climb function, causing one engine to climb and the plane to shift. And I'm looking at Luke Hopewell's face, and he's got this, like, all of the colour just drained out of your face.
I've got to get on a plane in 5 days. I'm checking the passenger list. Is everyone on board? Is he on board? He better not be on board.
So, okay, walk me through it. Exactly what is it he has claimed to do, Luke?
So basically what he's done is he's jacked into a little port underneath his seat that every single passenger has. It allows you to jack in and service the in-flight entertainment system. And using a bit of gadgetry and science, he's been able to hop
Ethernet cable.
It's an Ethernet cable. Do you remember? That's how we used to connect to the internet before Wi-Fi was invented.
Whoa, blue cables. He's been able to hop a couple of fences and get into the actual controls, the cabin controls of the plane. And what he actually has done is executed a few tests between 2011 and 2015, where he's done tests like, he's figured out how he can activate the emergency oxygen. He's figured out how he can make one engine travel faster than the other so that it can climb, and then he backed it back down. And
this
then
he sent while it. People are on the plane. Oh,
exactly.
I can't stop grinning. I know that Luke's terrified.
Oh, this sucks.
I love it when people find these flaws in systems. I find it fascinating, but it puts them in such a really interesting position. It's like you've done something
that's
fine. Has actually endangered a lot of people and is actually quite scary.
Well, the interesting thing is Chris Roberts is quite a well-respected hacker in the white hat hacking community.
Yeah.
He's been involved with DEF CON for many years.
Yeah.
He claims that he's been telling airline manufacturers about these problems for years. Is this still the best way of demonstrating it, though, Ray?
If you've got no other way of getting through to them, it's certainly a way of demonstrating it, isn't it? I think when you're banging your head against the wall telling people these are problems that exist and they're that, you know, technologically illiterate that they're just not listening to the experts on the matter, you have to do something to grab their attention. You don't have to. I don't want it to sound like I'm condoning his actions.
It really does actually sound like
really
you do.
It really does sound like I'm condoning his actions.
Ray Johnson says stunt hacking is okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Put that down as a quote. But look, it's worked, hasn't it?
Well, I guess so. I mean, do you think, has there been any change in how airlines are going to behave? I mean, because the other interesting thing here is that increasingly we are seeing airlines introducing in-flight Wi-Fi, introducing more accessibility when you're 35,000 feet up in the air. Do you think events like this will change the way airlines behave?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, especially when the general public know about it and that kind of fear that surrounds any event like this, where they go, you know, being able to access the internet while we're on a plane, someone's going to hack into it, they're going to crash the plane. It just creates this atmosphere of fear and public outrage, and airlines have to react to that. And they have to react in a way that keeps the money flowing and keeps their passengers happy.
It is interesting in the sense that people's fear is so important when it comes to flying, in a way that it isn't for like 99% of all other kinds of travel, even though you are more likely to get hit by a car than fall out of the sky.
Absolutely.
Which I'm saying to you is reassurance, Luke Hopewell.
What's interesting about this, you mentioned DEF CON before, and this guy is has been in this security community for a while. Plane manufacturers, it's good that he's put this on the public agenda, because plane manufacturers and aviation experts have been very secretive about the security systems on planes. They figure it's security through obscurity, despite the fact that that's a horrible thing to say.
It's also the moment you start talking about security, plane, midair. Like, yeah. The moment, even though you can say, we're doing this to fix a problem, the moment that's out in the public ether, they're kind of... It fills you with dread. You know, yeah. Even if the story is positive, the mere fact that that's even a possibility
Absolutely.
Is terrifying.
You know, and in this case, it was being done by someone for, you know, a positive purpose. But, yeah, that's not to say that it can't be done by someone for a, you know, more nefarious one.
There are a few things going on at the moment in the aviation space. I know United, I believe, are having a bug bounty where they're inviting people to come and look for problems in their security systems while the plane is on the ground. Do you think that they are being open enough, Luke, about what they're doing to deal with security threats as we move into this, you know, internet in the sky future?
Internet of things, as it's called, sort of, you know, more connected devices and more sort of human interface devices on the machines that we use. We're in this whole universe where everything's connected now, and airline manufacturers do need to do more. It's good that United have a bug bounty, and I think, you know, Qantas, Virgin, all these airlines around the world should hold hack days and say, hey, here's 10 hackers. I want you to take this plane apart so that we can absolutely fix the problems
that
are going on with it.
That's a reality show waiting to happen. Hackers take apart a plane.
Wow.
I would watch that.
Tesla did something similar. Tesla secretly gave the hackers at DEF CON a Model S to say, you know, this car has a lot of tech in it. Yeah. This car's all electric. There's a lot of systems networked. Here's a car. Break it, because we want to find out how unsafe it is and we want to fix those
things. That's
interesting. Is anyone really surprised that it would be Tesla that would do that?
Yeah.
They did it on the down low, though, because none of these companies ever want to say, hey, look what hackers can do with your car.
Yeah.
They never ever want to do that. So they gave it to them on the sly.
We don't actually have any proof that he was actually able to do any of this stuff. He's tweeted about it. He's bragged about it, for lack of a better term. But there's no evidence. Like, he was questioned by the FBI, but they didn't keep him.
Yeah, and he was saying that the tests that he conducted, even the pilots wouldn't really be aware that they happened.
I feel like if one of your engines is going faster than the other and you start turning a corner in the sky, I feel like if a pilot's not noticing that, he needs to lay off the mid-air champagne.
So are you calling a bluff on this one?
Well, I'm not the only one. I think Kevin Mitnick, who's quite a well-known security expert, he also said, until I see actual proof, I don't believe it. And I'm just exercising a little bit of skepticism, because one day this story might turn out to be bullshit and I want this little grab that says, Mark wasn't entirely sure.
So, hackers, if you're going to hack a plane, take over everyone's screen and write the words hacked, la 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 la.
Yes,
on the
actually,
screen.
La, 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 or that screenshot from the end of Independence Day with like a little skull and bones, which
only
clearly,
if he's got a Mac. Only if he's got a Mac.
Aliens use Mac.
Or just bring up one of those little loading bars that go hacking and it hacking comes across the bottom of everyone's in flight entertainment system.
Hacking, buffering. Welcome to the nerdiest show on Australian radio. My name is Mark Fennell. It is called Download This Show, where each week we get a panel of people that are far smarter than me, which isn't that hard, let's be honest, to talk about the week in technology. We have Ray Johnson and Luke Hopewell in the building. And from the moment smartwatches were introduced, they presented a fairly vague value proposition. They're a little bit fitness band. They're a little bit calendar on your wrist. There's not really enough apps for them, particularly for the Apple Watch. But what's interesting about technology, and actually the thing I like most about technology, is seeing how when a device enters the market, people take it and use it in ways it wasn't intended. And one of the interesting areas that's happening, particularly with the Apple Watch and Android Wear, is in the area of assistive technologies for people with disabilities. There are certain app developers that are taking up the challenge of using wearables to make life easier. And one of those is Proloquo to Go.
So if you launch a Proloquo for Text watch app, you get a screen that shows four choices. So you can either use your finger on the screen and swipe down and up through the list, or you can use the digital crown, and that way you can navigate through the sentences that you've programmed. Typically pick a short label. So for example, I have here one sentence that says understand. I tap on it, and what will happen is that it will then generate full screen the text, I can understand you, but I'm not able to speak.
Okay, I'm David Niemeyer, and I'm the CEO and founder of Assistiveware, a company based in the Netherlands that makes assistive technology for Mac and iOS. One of the things that we do is create apps for people who cannot speak. And a few years ago, we created an app called Proloquo for Text.
So Proloquo for Text allows people who are unable to speak or whose speech is really hard to understand a way to communicate with the iPhone or the iPad that uses text-to-speech. You can type, it has word prediction, you can define your own phrases. And what we recently did with the Apple Watch is create an Apple Watch app for Prologo for Text so that those people who use Prologo for Text can define a set of phrases on their iPhone that they can quickly access from their watch. And as third-party developers, we don't currently have access to text-to-speech on the watch. So what we do is when your user selects one of the phrases on the watch, we show the message full screen and we flip it so that if you turn your wrist towards your communication partner, they can read text very easily. And in practice, what we see is that many users of this kind of technology, is called AAC, Augmentative and Alternative Communication, anyway do not rely that much on text-to-speech and sound output, because there are many settings, like if you're in a bar where no one would hear what you're saying, even if you had a good speaker. And so being able to flick your wrist and show the message that you you want to give is really convenient. The environment obviously is quite more limited than an iPhone or an iPad, which have tremendous processing power available and a much larger screen. So you really need to think, how can I minimize this and go really to the essence of what we're trying to do? And that's how we came to, you know, not trying to build novel sentences and have really tiny little buttons, but instead let the user pre-program the sentences that they would like to have on their watch. And then with a simple tap, have access to those messages. So you're really like every time you need to focus on the particular platform. We had the same experience when we had software on the Mac. We moved to the iPhone. You have to rethink the way things work, and then you get a really great experience. What is easier in a way is if you have limited means, because you're dealing with a small screen, and don't have access to a lot of processing power, you can really minimize your design, and that allowed us to create this app pretty quickly. What to me was the greatest surprise is how clear and easily read that screen is. Because if you use this watch app and you have this sentence of, you know, maybe 6-7 words, and someone is sitting across the table, they can actually read it. And that to me was really the biggest surprise. I had not expected this level of clarity.
That is just a taste of Proloquo to Go. You are listening to Download This Show. It is your guide to the week in technology, the internet and culture. Welcome back to our panel. We have Ray Johnson from Lifehacker, Kotaku and Mornings on Channel 9. And Luke Hopewell, the editor of Gizmodo Australia. Luke, you need more titles to work for. Like,
yeah,
I'm lagging behind.
I've got a few more I could throw in there as well, but I didn't want to overshadow you
actually
too
run,
much.
I've run out of space on my screen to write down your CV. I'll just open up your LinkedIn next time we do this. All right, we are talking about how wearable technology, smartwatches in particular, might help people with disabilities. Some interesting example back there. Are there other examples in this space that you think are particularly effective?
Well, look, not even necessarily wearables, but where technology is heading and where it even is currently utilized for helping people with disabilities is pretty huge. You look at things that you might not have even thought about being intended for people with disabilities, like LiveScribe. You know, if you're taking notes and then you can just, you know, press on your page at any given moment and it can repeat back to you what you've written. That can help reduce levels of anxiety with people with dyslexia,
yeah, right.
You know, all those sorts of things. So it all kind of feeds into this.
So for people that haven't heard of LiveScribe before, yeah, i.e. me, because yep, I'm an yep. idiot, what actually is it?
It's a pen, essentially, an oldie worldie pen like this, but it's got some technology built in so that you write on this special paper, which is probably my only real downside to it because it costs a small fortune
I'll bet.
For the paper.
It's like, you know, for years, like Canon and companies like that used to just live off the
ink. Lock you in on the ink.
On the ink cartridge, that would be the 2015 version of that.
But not only does it record what you're taking notes for, it's really good for lectures and things.
Mm.
So it records the audio, but it also transfers what you've written on the paper to an electronic version, converts that into written text so that you don't have to, you know, do anything with it at all. But you can also make little marks on the page so that it can save those little spots in the talk that you wanted to really highlight and go back back. If you can't write quick enough, essentially, you could just draw a little star and it will know that that's the point in the recording that you want to listen to again.
Amazing.
Yeah, really
cool. You can tell I'm excited because I hit like some yeah. new register at the top.
So these sorts of things have been brought out to help people in meetings or uni students, but they can also help people with certain disabilities that get really, you know, anxious and stressed out by having to deal with those in those kinds of settings.
Luke, I know you have a particular interest in eye tracking and its potential role in assistive technology.
Yeah, eye tracking is a really fantastic piece of technology that allows you to associate eye movements with particular actions on a computer. So, for example, you can have an eye match a keyboard to write out a word and then have it spoken for you and things like that. There are huge amounts of implications that of where you can put that in that can help people with limited motion or various disabilities.
It's actually really cool because they've used eye motion technology. There's a charity in the UK called Special Effect. That's the charity group Medic that I'm involved in. We support them. And they've used eye tracking technology so that one of their disabled gamers can play GTA 5.
That's
amazing.
And this
guy finished GTA 5 just using his eyeballs.
You don't have a huge range of motion with your eyes as you do with your hands, for example, where you're moving them around and you have a huge amount of control with your digits and fingers. That's very, very easy to actually say, well, this amount of pressure equals this action and this amount of touch with these amount of fingers and where your hands are specifies either in motion control or on touch screens exactly what you want to do, and you can really refine that. The problem with eye tracking technology is that you've got a range of motion that's much, much smaller and a range of actions and clicks that are actually trigger a few actions which maybe aren't as specific. So you can blink twice for this, or you can move your eye left or up.
Okay, so that's really interesting because I remember a couple of years ago on this show we spoke to a guy that was using Microsoft Kinect as a way of helping people with phantom limb syndrome. Mm-hmm. So what would happen is partly their current understanding of phantom limb syndrome is that a lot of it is what's going on in your mind, and the pain is emerging from your mind kind of creating something. And they did a little bit of research that found if you see somebody reflect an image of themselves reflected back with the arm reattached, it can actually help with that. No one's saying it cures it, but it certainly can help with it. What sort of technologies would they be using with eye tracking? I mean, in my mind, I'm assuming things like Google Glass and whatnot.
Very sensors and cameras are two things in you know, modern space that are becoming much, much cheaper, so that you can deploy these things without a huge amount of cost, and meaning that it's not hugely prohibitive for the people that need this technology, because obviously distributing it all comes down to cost. Smaller cameras with great macro functionality that can actually track the eyes, but that can also lock onto the irises and things like that, that detect more light going in and out of the iris and things like that. It's all about fine motor control and really figuring out what you're actually looking at and how you're actually moving to respond to that actual input itself.
Do you know what I love? I love as this conversation has extended, each one of us in this room has started widening our eyes more and more.
Going, you do things with your eyes when you're talking about your eyes.
This odd, like, psychosomatic reaction. Now, the other angle to all of this, coming back to smartwatches, is that there is an interesting challenge that is presented to app developers now to make apps work for smartwatches and using the different bits of technology that it has that, say, normal phones don't, in terms of particularly just looking at the Apple Watch, the haptic responses and the kind of the little gyroscope they've got in it. Who do you think's doing apps for watches well? Like, who do you think's nailing it at the moment?
I think one of the real challenges with the smartwatch is you have a lot of developers that see it as basically a tiny version of a bigger screen, and they try to cram far too much into that instead of just really paring down the functionality to its basics, because that's all you really need. Uber does a really good job. Uber's the one app for me that has really stood out as being an example of, hey, tap, done.
Dealing
with heaps of menus and functions and bits and pieces and tiny little things that you can't read.
I was actually going to touch on Uber as well, because, yeah, they've done a great job on their Apple Watch, but from an accessibility perspective, they can definitely do more. Uber very recently has rolled out something called Uber Assist, which connects you with UberX drivers. That's their ride-sharing drivers.
They're potentially illegal ride-sharing drivers.
The one that we're all meant to be rallying against, right?
Yeah. They've actually got the top tier of UberX drivers and said, right, we're going to train you in all this special training so that you can help people with limited range of motion, with different things that need sort of assisted transport and things like that. So we can bring that to the Uber platform. It's called Uber Assist. The problem with the Watch app is that it lets you order an UberX car, but nothing else. You can open the app, press OK, but you don't know if you're getting an assist driver.
See, when that you might speaks need to it. The really interesting challenge of limited real estate, doesn't mm-hmm. it? Yeah. I think that's something that both platforms of smartwatch are really struggling with, which is how much information do you include? How many options do you include? And it's even like in more kind of generalist apps, like the Twitter app, they'll show you what's trending. They'll show you what's on your Twitter feed. As far as I can tell, you can't see mentions, like when somebody tweets at you. It's like, that seems like such a no-brainer. And it is notable the absence of sort of the big platform ones. So, for example, there's still no Facebook, Apple Watch, or I believe there's no one for Android Wear either. I could be wrong.
There are notification cards, but it's not as extensive as it could be.
Yeah.
From an accessibility point of view, I think not just Apple Watch, but also Android Wear have a really interesting proposition that they can do by looking at the watch as not a companion or remote device to the phone, but looking at it as a standalone device.
Absolutely.
So what could someone do from an accessibility point of view if they had this as a standalone device?
Yep.
Draw all these services, like, say, for example, you've got Google Wallet or Apple Pay, so that people don't have to fumble for their wallet.
Yeah, that'd be good, actually. All right, you convince me, Luke.
You've got, it's got Bluetooth in it so that you can pair an earpiece to it. It can talk directions at you after you input it with your voice and things like that. It can give you haptic responses to, say, turn left, turn right, or give you new notifications about things that you've got so that you don't need to stop, break your activity, stop what you're doing and check all of these things. If developers look at it from an end-to-end standalone accessibility point of view, I think they'll come up with some great ideas.
And maybe the way around, that's just occurred to me with the UberX thing, maybe instead of trying to cram all of these features into the one app, having separate apps with those specialized accessible features for people with disabilities might be the way to go.
Yeah.
You know, having a whole new category on the App Store, which is, hey, these are apps specifically developed as a standalone with those features so that you don't have to fumble around.
All right. Download This Show is what you are listening to. It is your guide to the week in technology, the internet and culture. We are in studio here with our panel, Luke Hopewell from Gizmodo and Ray Johnson from Lifehacker, Kotaku, and like 50 other things. Mark Fennell is my name. And it seems like such an altruistic, if somewhat vague goal. You might have seen these ads for something called internet.org by Facebook. But the interesting thing about internet.org, and we'll talk about exactly what it is it's supposed to be, is that it's gotten lots of people riled up. This week, 60 people from digital rights groups in 28 countries or regions around the world signed a joint letter to Mark Zuckerberg criticising internet.org's practices on fairness, privacy and security grounds. Drama. Let's, though, start with exactly what actually is internet.org.
You hit the nail on the head, which is it's very utopian at the outset. It's Mark Zuckerberg standing on a stage and saying, you get some internet and you get free internet and you get all the internet. But that, that's...
least charismatic man in the world.
In a hoodie.
From his hoodie and flip-flops.
Yeah.
The problem with it is that it's Facebook net. It's not the internet.
Right.
Basically, what internet.org does is it goes to developing nations which don't have huge internet access and says to them, you can get through this provider free access to the internet. Good for you. Go get some internet. See what you can make with it, you crazy kids. The problem is that the only internet websites that they can get access to are the ones that Facebook has said okay to. It's also redefining net neutrality. Basically, net neutrality says that everything should be treated free and open on the internet, that no traffic should be prioritized over others. And internet.org sort of says that, well, that's your definition of net neutrality. Here's ours, which is nobody should tamper with the stuff that we say that you should be looking at. So all these internet privacy activists have basically come up and said, it's got a misleading name, it does misleading things, and you've sold it wrong. This is giving people a walled garden approach to the internet, which is not okay.
What's their rationale for why they're only limiting it to those sites? Is it just, we can only do so much bandwidth? Is that the argument they're
That's pretty much it. I mean, you can't solve the internet in a day. You can't go and say the whole internet's free because it would cost them literally all of their money. Like, fixing the internet's a big deal, and good on them for giving it a go, but this is probably the wrong road to walk down to try and fix it.
Look, from a very cynical perspective, this is...
When
you look at it, it's hard not to see this as Facebook going, we've got so many users now. Why aren't we extending our reach even further? Wait, there's people out there that don't have internet, you guys. It's like a rich kid just like throwing little crumbs into a poor neighborhood and going, you should be really happy about this. Now use our service. And you know, the sites that they're signing up for, they're free for like a trial period. And then it's going to go into, if you download anything, you're being charged data.
The other, I guess, side of this is, I think in the last couple of years, there's been lots of different programs to bring internet to places where it is not necessarily set up and the infrastructure isn't there for it. We've seen everything, I think, from balloons that have the internet to suitcases that can operate as a giant Wi-Fi network. Is there a really good plan that we should be backing? Like, is there, because I see we've got all these sort of piecemeal versions of it. Is there something that you've seen out there in terms of bringing the internet to inaccessible parts of the world that you're like, that's the one, that's the winner?
Google Loon, the one with the balloons that we talked about, is a really great idea. It's very interesting in how it's going to work. I'm not entirely sure how they're going to get internet to the masses, you know, down below. But I certainly think that by fixing the pipe, if you will, fixing the actual physical infrastructure before you go to the soft layer of the internet and say, well, you can have all these websites for free. It's like giving someone, that's like giving someone like a car with no engine in it. If they don't have pipes that are fixed that actually work and have access to the internet, then that's a problem.
It's like having a fridge full of condiments and nothing to eat.
I know university students that live off that, so I think that's probably fine.
The other interesting thing is how device manufacturers are going to the developing world to try and fix that hardware infrastructure as well. Simply because, you know, we've got, you know, in the Western world, we're all about, oh, iOS and Android. But if you go and have a look at smaller operating systems like Ubuntu OS, Firefox OS that are being distributed in places like India on $35 phones, this is something that really is going to bring the internet to the developing world. You know, people come up with really, really great ways to connect each other with very limited bandwidth. I think I read a story a couple of years ago in somewhere in Africa that they were doing internet banking and micropayments using SMS because they had proper cellular networks and had cellular networks for ages, but they still all had Nokia 3315s. So they figured out a way to pair everything back so
and
that you can do it.
And they will have them forever.
Yeah, so that you can do it in 160 characters.
Because they last. Those
they
damn
do.
Phones, they last.
Do.
To quote scientists and real scientist Dr. Ian Malcolm, life finds a way.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
There's not enough Jurassic Park references in this show. That is all we have time for here on Download This Show. Very big thank you to this week's panel, Rae Johnson from Lifehacker Kotaku. You can see her on mornings on Channel 9. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you for having me again.
And Luke Hopewell from Gizmodo. Thank you for coming back.
Thanks, as always.
Don't forget, you can find the show on Facebook. Just search for RN's Download This Show. We are at RN Download on Twitter. My name is Mark Fennell, and thank you for listening to another episode of Download This Show.